Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the February episode of AZMcast. It's the one you've been waiting for, influenza. Just in time for flu season to be over, just about. But better late than never. It's the thought that counts, and all those other lame excuses for procrastination can be inserted right here. This month, Jared, Brian, Allie, and I discuss the flu in all of its glory and all of its misery. From the walking wounded to the walking dead, we will pore over the diagnosis, the management, and the prevention of flu as it pertains to your patients in the emergency department. As a special bonus, Brian has brought his tinfoil hat to distract the pharma black helicopters from his thoughts on oseltamivir. Very interesting discussion that you want to consider for yourself before you actually start prescribing those wonderful five-day treatments. So get your flu shot, crawl under the covers, and rest up in preparation for this month's AZMcast on influenza. We're going to talk about flu this month, and we're joined by an expert, a local expert on influenza, Dr. Jared Mosier, because he actively has influenza.
That is correct.
Why are you here if you have the flu?
I wouldn't miss spending time with you in an enclosed environment while I'm viral for anything in the world.
So we're joined by Jared and Allie and Brian to talk about influenza. Jared also, congratulations, had a baby girl yesterday.
Thank you.
Aubrey Rose?
Aubrey Elizabeth.
Aubrey Elizabeth.
It was going to be Rose. We changed it. Last minute audible.
Okay. So I'm not that far. So you have influenza and you have a two-day-old baby.
Yep.
Why are you here? I guess there's...
I can't be around the baby. I can't really be at home, so...
Might as well be here.
Might as well be here.
All right. Well, we're happy you're here.
How many days of illness are you now?
Four.
Okay.
Three. This is day four.
I think we're day negative three now.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the incubation period now.
Nice. All right. So Jared is going to help us to describe the first part of our discussion on influenza, which is the clinical features of flu. Jared, describe to us in as much detail, using like onomatopoeias if you can, to describe your flu-like symptoms and how this all went down.
Well, you know, we always assume that we have the flu when it's like I start with a runny nose and then I get congested and then I get a sore throat and then I get a cough, you know, a few days later. But the difference between adenovirus, URI, I feel terrible, and the flu is sudden onset. I feel like I've been hit by a truck. I've got body aches. I've got fevers and I have a non-productive cough, so on and so forth. And that's exactly how I felt. I woke up in the morning with like a little tickle in my throat, and then by 4 hours later, I had just horrible body aches. My joints were killing me, and I had a fever that was unrelenting from Tylenol or Motrin, more than 102, and I had a bad cough. My chest felt like it was on fire. And that was within 4 hours of waking up with a little tickle in my throat.
Now, Allie, can you help us to differentiate between what Jared's describing and man flu? Because I don't think that Jared, Brian, or I can accurately distinguish, because that's how I feel anytime I get sick.
Yeah, well, I think Jared does not have a man flu because he's physically up off the couch and somewhere within 4 days, 3 to 4 days of onset. I think man flu is from an observer, much less severe. than the symptoms that Jared is describing. But, you know, that's just my opinion, which clearly is biased.
I would say that man flu probably exerts a delirium onto the patient of where they perceive that their sickness is way worse than it actually is. It's got to be one of the hallmark features of man flu. We're going to talk about treatment for flu. We're going to talk about different things you can do. I think the only thing you can do for man flu is an emergent adiperitomy. I'm going to let that one sink in for a little bit. I've probably seen 100 cases of flu this month with my attending level shifts, you know, that we all work. So, you know, I've seen so much flu that I feel like I've got a good idea of what people look like when they're fluish. Lots of kids come in and they've, you know, got maybe a little cold, their sniffles or something. And then there's that kid you look at, their eyes are half open. They just look miserable, but they don't look critical. Like if I saw a kid with pneumonia that looked like that, I'd be super worried. But otherwise, it's like, nah, they probably have flu. And plenty of patients say, Doc, I've had the flu before. This is nothing like that. And my response has been, no, you've never had the flu before. Now you've had the flu. This is what actual influenza feels like. So with that, do you think there's a role for just giving people a clinical diagnosis of the flu and saying, you've got influenza, go home, fluids, ibuprofen, and Tylenol. I hope you feel better in a week and a half.
Yes. I mean, this is infectious disease 101, right? How do infectious disease spread? They spread from person to person. So if I see you and I keep you in my ER or the waiting room or the hospital longer, the more chance that you can spread that virus to someone else. So to me, if I see someone who has clinical symptoms of influenza, I want them out of the ER. I want them home. I don't want them going to work. I don't want them seeing anyone. I want them sitting, like you said, resting, taking some meds, getting some fluids in, and recovering until they're not contagious, because otherwise they're just going to keep spreading the disease. So what does a test do for me in that situation? What we're really looking for are who are the sick ones that would need to stay or need some other intervention, right? The walking flu, you know what they look like, right? Jared is a walking flu right now. Does he need to stay in the hospital? No. To me, what you're really trying to do is, if you can clinically diagnose these, which I think you can, because if you look at someone and their oxygen levels are fine, their work of breathing's fine, they're not super tachycardic, they're not hypotensive, you know, and they look, like you said, Aaron, run down and kind of like, and as Jared's describing, a bus hits you all of a sudden, and they just have no pep, no energy, you know what they have. They're not runny nose for 3 days and the kid's running around the room. You want these patients home. So to me, what does a test add? Nothing. And when we do tests, we're asking a nurse to come face to face with this person and do a little swabby swabby and get up in their business.
Stick something in their nose so they cough.
Right. And you can't do that from across the room. I mean, you probably could, but that'd be illegal and involve darts. But at the same time, so you're just going to ask for more spread. So I don't need a test, and we can talk about the test later. They're not that great. And so I don't need a test to help determine what I'm going to do for this patient. It just doesn't change anything.
Can I add a couple things to that? So I think from an epidemiology, public health monitoring, how, you know, where should we divert resources to kind of standpoint, it's helpful to test people at least that are admitted to the hospital at the beginning and the end of the flu season. So you can see, are we really ramping into the flu season? Are we slowing down? And during the flu season, what is the predominant strain? And is there Tamiflu resistance, that kind of stuff. I do not think when you're in the thick of flu season like we are right now that you need to swab all these people. That seems ridiculous, especially the ones that you're going to send home.
I think we're talking about two different kinds of flus as well. We're talking about flu that comes in and says, I feel horrible, but they're walking, they're talking, and then there's the ones that need to be admitted. So for the flu swab that we're doing, like Jared said, I think it's kind of like, do we need a CBC? No, but the inpatient team's going to want it, so maybe we should just get it. If it helps downstream, I think that's fine.
I'll be honest. It also depends on what kind of flu test it is. So I'll give you an example. We got all these patients transferred here who are on ventilators with ARDS that we don't know what it is, flu test was negative. It's always positive, right? Because at other hospitals, they're using the assay and not the PCR. And the whatever, the immunoassay is always negative. It's a terrible study. And then you get a respiratory sample and you get a PCR and it's clearly positive, you know? And so if it's just an immunoassay or a Western blot or something, don't even waste your time or money on that. If you do at your hospital a PCR, that's probably a better test to do in the instance that you want to do a rapid test.
Right. And I think what Jared's talking about too is any epidemiologic study for an infectious disease, if you're doing the testing for that, it's reasonable. We do that for chlamydia, we do it for HIV, for whatever. If you're wanting to get a sample of your population and see what's going on, sure, if they want to test for a period of time, I think that's reasonable. And we talk about sensitivity, specificity of, say, the PCR, even as a good sensitivity and specificity, is better, but it's only 90% sensitivity, 95% sensitivity, and specificity. These are more specific tests, right? So you're going to get more false negatives. The specificity of your PCR is around 98%. And a lot of the your rapid flu tests, they can range anywhere from like 60 to 70% sensitivity. So if you imagine, right, that's what's your false negative rate in that? 1 in 3, 1 in 2 sometimes on a really bad one. So you can get a lot of false negatives, but you're probably not going to get many false positives. So if you do get a positive in your rapid test, that's probably accurate. But PCR is a better test. Is it like a 100% test? No, but just so we know, we're talking test characteristics, it is a better test.
So it's important to know what kind of flu swab you have for your rapid flu and for your reflex thereafter. For our flu swab that we have, I'll cite the performance characteristics that were actually sent off. And remember, this is for flu A and flu B. So for flu A, the sensitivity is 81%. Specificity is 97%. For flu B, the sensitivity is 86%. The specificity is 99%. So if it's positive, it's positive. And if it's negative, it is likely still to be positive if clinically they have flu. This is one of the things that I find residents early in their training struggle with a little bit is, I don't know, the person just looks terrible. Well, do you think they have the flu? I don't know, maybe. Versus later in their training, that guy's got flu. That lady's got flu. So I don't need the test. I know that they have flu. If you need this test to train your haggis, that brain-gut hybrid that we have, that we've used to replace Gestalt, if you need that, then that's fine as part of a teaching benefit. But not everybody needs the flu test if they clinically look like they have flu, because again, there's this feeling that there's this all-knowing, all-powerful test that's going to be positive or negative, and that's just going to be the end of it. And as physicians, we know that that's just not how tests work.
And there was a study, and I have to get, it's either the Ebel or the Dugas study, but it looked at actually clinical sensitivity specificity for clinicians, and our sensitivity is around 60 to 70%, and our specificity is around 60 to 70%. So the sensitivity is about the same as these rapid tests. The specificity for the test is a little bit better.
How do you guys deal with patients when they come in? You know, patients demand testing. They think there's a test for everything that's out there. And when they don't get the test and you're discussing with them your clinical judgment, how do you navigate that?
So one thing I tell them is I draw on the board a picture of a nose and I show them how far back we need to shove that swab. And then I tell them that there's probably not much we can do about it, even if it is flu. And then they're willing to take my word for it.
I like that. I just tell them, I think you have the flu, right? Because they're usually coming in asking, do I have the flu? And if I think they have it, I just tell them they have it and go along like, I think you have influenza. This is going to take 2 weeks to get you better. You need some rest. You need a doctor's note. Let's treat this. I'm on board with you. So that's what I do. I think it's the ones where if you're asked a question and they say, do I have this? And you don't think they have it, and they think they have it and want to test, that's a different conversation. But for influenza, I don't run into that as much. That would be more for me, like, you know, we talked about with PCARN or something like that. I think my kid needs a head CT because they're bleeding, and how do we, you know, deal with that question? But for influenza, I don't know if you guys run into that, but
I haven't really had any issues.
My patients all have tubes in their mouths. So I just, Jared, I want a flu swab. Get a flu swab.
When was the last history you could get from a patient? 3T. 3T.
Touche.
I think that it's a confidence thing. I took care of a patient whose mom was a paramedic back when I was an intern or maybe even a medical student. And I took care of her, and she said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "Absolutely." I said, "All right, so here's what's going on with your kid. Here's what we're going to do, and this is the plan." She goes, "You have a lot more confidence than when I last saw you." I was like, "Thank you. That's actually really nice to hear." And I think that goes a long way. When you've got confidence in what you say, then I think people are more going to believe you. If your mechanic goes, "I don't know, maybe you need a new transmission," you're not going to get a new transmission from that person. So I think that carries a lot of weight when you have some confidence.
I know a lot of people who are really confident and not very accurate.
Oh, I didn't say accurate, but will somebody trust you because of your confidence? I have one word for you, politician.
I was going to say, that's a confidence man, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a con man. There's a, you know, with all the testing, I have residents a lot that will test for flu. They come in, they do their presentation, and they say, so, you know, they come in, they look well, they got some fevers and stuff, so I'm going to test them for flu, and then I'm going to send them home. And so I politely, I hope, ask, so why, you know, if the flu's negative, what are you going to do? I'm going to send them home. And what if it's positive? Well, I'm going to send them home. So does it really matter what the flu swab is? Well, I kind of want to know. So that's one thing I hear. And the other thing I hear is, you know, well, the patient wants to know. I think both of those, to a degree, are valid. The third one that I like and actually will agree with is it will stop the diagnostic workup. So if I tell you you have influenza, then people will stop looking for everything else. No more chest x-rays, no blood work, no errant CBCs, and for the little babies, no spinal taps, no urines, no everything else. Totally fine with that. So for that one, if it's going to stop the diagnostic momentum, which is one we can't wait to cover sometime this year, then I'm fine with it. Because the patient wants to know, Brian touched on this a bit, but if the patient wants to know whether or not it's flu, you can tell them with confidence, if you are certain, you have flu. There's not a doubt. You've got all the hallmarks of flu, you've got all the symptoms of flu, and I have seen 8 cases of flu today. There are 8 of your neighbors here that also have flu. I promise you have flu. And if the patient still wants to know, at that point, what I will do is offer to swab them, and then I will say, I will call you if the flu swab is positive or negative, because there's no reason for a patient who's going to go home, regardless of the test, to stay in the ER to wait for a test when we could be seeing another patient. So that would be my suggestion. Grab a sticker, grab some contact info, and then look them up in an hour, and if the flu's positive or negative, make a phone call. I'm very sorry that you're sick. Here's what the swab was. I hope you feel better. For the I want to know whether or not it's flu, if you have not seen a lot of flu, then that's fine. You need to understand what influenza A looks like, and after a while, you'll start to see, wow, all these people that look like flu actually are flu. Eventually, you can start to cut it back, and I challenge some of you to make a clinical diagnosis of flu. Make sure that it's not sepsis from pyelonephritis or pneumonia or something else, but if they otherwise appear well and they look like flu, we're burning through these swabs. Every year, we, at some point, run out or at least run very low on the nasal swabs that it takes to do these viral swabs from the inpatient side, from the ED side. So consider whether or not this test is actually worth it.
I think Aaron makes a good point too. If you're testing a patient, you're going to send them home anyway. I think that's a great way to do it in terms of getting their contact information, because, you know, we're going to talk about patient flow later this year as well. But that's a number one, it's a patient flow thing. Number two, we talked about exposure earlier. The longer that patient sits there coughing and infecting the rest of the department and that room to, for the next patient, because really can't, let's be honest, we cannot truly disinfect every room in between patients. So, you know, get that patient home because that will help minimize the spread of disease.
This is like the ER version of kitchen nightmares of like you see behind the scenes. Wait a minute, so this one has flu and gonorrhea and bed bugs. So I wanted to talk real quick about flu A versus flu B. Has anyone here seen flu B this season?
Just as a quick note, when we first recorded this session back in early January, we had not seen a whole lot of flu B. We have more than made up for it since then.
It's been all H3N2, I think, this season.
So it has been a lot of flu A, and that's almost always the predominant flu that at least we've been seeing here in Tucson. When I start to see flu B, I've seen it later in the year, and I've seen a different presentation. For me, and this is just anecdotally, I've seen a lot of complex febrile seizures in kids that end up being flu B. I've seen a lot of other kind of strange presentations that end up being flu B that aren't your typical Rigers, body aches. For me, I've seen they tend to be sicker kids. And that kind of lends me toward wanting to test in people that are sicker. For you, Jared, what have you seen as kind of the presenting thing for the patients that end up in the ICU? Because what I've found is I get a patient who is sick, they look septic, they've got a pneumonia, they're hypoxic, whatever it is, they're just generally sick, and we manage them supportively, and then, oh yeah, by the way, they have flu.
Kind of depends on what the predominant strain that year is. So if it's just seasonal flu, then it's patients at risk. The 65-year-old who has COPD and gets pneumonia or something like that, and oh, by the way, they have flu. When it's the H1N1 years and those kinds of things, then it's the young, otherwise healthy people who get whacked with this inflammatory reaction that puts them on ventilators and ECMO and all that stuff. So although this is a very severe year, I guess you ever listened to 1A on NPR? They had a whole thing on the flu yesterday, and they had Tim Uecke and a couple other people. Tim Uecke is the flu director for the CDC. He was on there, and they were saying this is a moderate to severe year for sure, but moderate to severe for seasonal influenza. And that's pretty consistent with what we're seeing. The ICU is bursting at the seams and there's tons of patients on ventilators, but we don't have anybody on ECMO. So as opposed to last year, where...
It's a strange victory.
Yeah. Whereas last year and the year before, where I was... The year before last, I was sounding the alarms with Tim Uecke saying, hey, man, we're not seeing a lot of flu cases, but we have 12 people on ECMO. And with that predominant strain was the H1N1 strain, but it just happened to be there was a ton of Tamiflu resistance that year too. So to us, it totally depends on what the predominant strain is.
So the flu season has been bad this year. I have heard numbers thrown out like the flu vaccine this year was only about 10% effective. I couldn't find anywhere to verify that, but just that the flu vaccine itself was not that useful this year. You guys all got your flu shot?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I mean, I got mine. I haven't had influenza yet.
Well, you know, even though it's not entirely effective, it probably keeps you off a ventilator.
Squad goals.
I mean, part of it.
There you go. That needs to be in the propaganda.
It works. It stimulates your immune system for something. I mean, H's and N's that we talk about, right? Influenza. It's H's and N's and different combinations every year. And when they come up with the flu vaccine, it's people in Japan and the U.S. who are thinking a year ahead and trying to figure out which H's and N's are going to be most likely this coming year.
And what can they make?
Right. And then they have to get that to the manufacturers in March, and the manufacturers then start to produce it March through the end of summer, and then they have to push it out. Mm-hmm. So the hard part with this is coming up with the right answer, because they don't know. It's a prediction model, and it's, you know, some models are wrong. But at the same time, we're still dealing with H's and N's, which have to look somewhat alike to our body and somehow stimulate some kind of an immune response that if they see a similar looking H and N, they know what to do with.
Right.
And I agree. I think it probably prevents the severest illness. us.
Chris Williams couldn't be here, but he sent a couple points he wanted to make, and one of them was that flu season starts in the southern hemisphere before it gets to us, so we got a little bit of a head start, and we usually vaccinate when we kind of send out those strains against the standard ones, but then there are a couple other H's and N's that are selected by the experts at the World Health Organization, and that's kind of how they figure out which ones are we going to do this year. And his question was, when did the CDC discover that this year's vaccine wasn't going to work? And I'm guessing probably fairly recently.
I guess it depends on what you want out of a vaccine, right? I mean, if you want to eradicate varicella, then you want a vaccine that people are not going to get varicella, right? But the flu doesn't work that way. You know, you would love it to you not get the flu if you got the flu vaccine, but like Brian said, you're really trying to limit the most severe disease. I mean, you think, let's just marvel at something real quick. 100 years ago this year, between 35 and 100 million people died over a 5-month period from the flu. Yeah, and now, 100 years later, we're bitching about the fact that we got a little milder case of the flu, even though we got the flu vaccine, right? We're arguing about whether our one treatment works, Tamiflu.
Oh, we haven't even started that yet.
Well, but we will argue about that. You know what I mean? We and the antibiotics that we have for the secondary pneumonias that kill people if you do survive the flu are quickly developing resistance. So let's just marvel at the fact that 100 years ago, up to 100 million people died during one flu season.
But I think that was our only major population decrease in like the last 200, 500 years, except for maybe one of the world wars. Right. That was the only, like if you look at a chart, it's the only dip, which is wild.
But you think about what we have better supportive care and the flu vaccine.
Right.
And so you can't say the vaccine doesn't work even on the years where it's only 10% effective. It might not prevent you from getting the flu, but what will keep you alive.
So, still get your flu shots. Vaccines have not killed anyone yet.
Well, I will tell you this. I have never had someone that I've had to put on ECMO for the influenza that got a flu shot.
That's good anecdotal data.
I'm gonna push that out to the mainstream press. We'll see how that
I think
flies.
It's the one thing you can do to prevent yourself from, like you said, getting super sick or hospitalized. That's what you're doing. You're trying to minimize when you catch influenza that year, it's going to be less, right? It's like car insurance. Aaron likes his car analogies. This is a car insurance. Now you have your totaled car. Okay, well, I got a rental. Oh, cool. I can still drive around and get to work.
Yeah. I think for lay people, though, I mean, it's either sick or not sick. And so, if they get sick at all, it's the vaccine didn't work, obviously. I'm never going to get it again. But.
Or you have your little immune response a day or two after getting the flu vaccine, and you're like, oh, I got the flu because I feel mildly uncomfortable. Americans don't like feeling mildly uncomfortable. So even if the treatment is, gives you a little bit of pain, nope, forget it. I don't like that.
You need to educate your patients. The flu shot is not a live virus. It is chopped up parts of a virus. They cannot get the flu from the flu shot.
They certainly can have a symptomatic reaction to the chopped up virus.
Right. It's their immune system kicked in. And explain that. But I think this is part of an education piece that during influenza season we need to push to our patients, because this will help keep people out of the hospital and keep people from getting super sick, if not this year, maybe the next year, following years, and can stop the telephone chain of, oh, I got my flu shot and I got the flu the next day. We don't want that out there.
The immune system is certainly one of the most difficult parts for me in medical school, and it's no easier if you haven't gone through medical school I still don't understand a whole lot about it, but I do know that you cannot get influenza from the flu shot. Anyone that disagrees, please Twitter us or do it. Contact
Twitter,
us somehow.
Twitter. It's tweet. Tweet us, not Twitter us.
Twitter.
Leave it in. Leave it in. How do you work the VCR?
This beta machine don't work no more.
I send most of my...
We are recording this on dual track.
I've got reel to reel in my new office.
We'll send it out on an 8-track for those of you.
All right. So I think it's time. Brian, I left your tinfoil hat at home, but I am going to make one for you.
That's
so
okay.
It's time to talk oseltamivir.
Okay. We have to let Brian have the floor.
So right. I'm just going to say oseltamivir, and then I'm going to hide behind a bunker as Brian starts on your mark, get set, go.
So I've done some deep dives on this, and I have my own opinions. And I don't want to give you a jaded opinion. I want you guys to make up your own opinion. I have, and I know I'm the crazy person in the room here, right? I'm looking at three people who just see me in a straitjacket, and that's okay.
That's not true.
It's okay. I know where I'm coming from.
It's not tied down. It's just in that you wear it for comfort.
Right. I'm flapping my wings with the straitjacket on.
You're like Skipper. You just dress in the paper scrubs because it makes the other people feel comfortable. Yeah.
The World Health Organization started to talk about influenza worldwide. And maybe we have this drug called oseltamivir that we could prevent spread, and it's going to treat the disease, and we should probably look into this. So 2003, Kaiser put out a meta-analysis. And so the Kaiser article came out and was quoted then by the CDC and the World Health Organizations and talked about, because the Kaiser article looked at 5 randomized controlled trials and was lauding a couple things. So the two things mainly that they lauded was it was decreasing serious bacterial infections in these patients. So Jared was alluding to preventing serious bacterial infections or secondary bacterial infections after a case of influenza. So one of these was the main point. The other thing they were talking about was trying to get hospitalizations down, and this became a big push. And so when the hard part, though, with the Kaiser article, if you look at it, is that of the 6 authors in the Kaiser article, 5 received funding or spoke for Roche. So Roche is the company that makes oseltamivir. And as we know, if we look at any studies, whenever there's funding issues, you have to be skeptical. So that's kind of the opinion I want you to have with all this stuff. So if you look at the Kaiser article and you dive into it, they talked about a 10% versus 4.6% lower respiratory tract infections requiring antibiotics. And so oseltamivir, let's be appropriate, dropped at 6%. But if you really look at those, the things that they were talking about lower respiratory infections included acute bronchitis, sinusitis, and acute otitis media. So acute otitis media really isn't a lower respiratory infection. And sinusitis and acute bronchitis, we could probably argue, don't require antibiotics anyway. So if you look at the pneumonia rates in this article, it was 1.9 versus 1.8%, which is really not a significant drop in 0.1%. Also, if you look at the data that they present in the meta-analysis, they did not necessarily a straw man comparison, but they, similar to the TPA articles, they did different groups. So the group that received the placebo group was sicker, older, and more at-risk populations, and that was 38% versus 27%. So do you think that population group would probably need more antibiotics or be hospitalized more? Odds are yes, and 11%, it's really not an equal comparison. And in the Kaiser article, they talk about less hospitalizations, but out of 4,000 patients, there were only 10 patients less hospitalized. So it's not a significant difference, but this was what was lauded. So we talked about people stockpiling, and then what happened? Well, a couple years later, in 2006, you start to run into bird flu. And bird flu hit, and that scared a lot of people, right? I mean, Asia, it was a mess over there. People were in masks. It was a big nightmare. Really didn't affect us as much in North America, but in the Asiatic countries, huge. 2006, Cochrane did their first review on oseltamivir and took a look at it. And they said, well, the Kaiser article concludes that there's maybe some reduced complications, but there's a low effectiveness of oseltamivir, so we really can't recommend a routine use of the drug. So after that, 2009, I remember practicing in 2009 and H1N1 hit. And that was a pretty big scare. And people, were you guys practicing during that time? And I was in Guam, so it was a different take because we're all on an island and no one could really leave. So.
I remember a kid with H1N1 when it was just starting. We knew he had tested positive. We didn't know what it meant. And I ran into the room because he was having a DSAT and he hawked a giant loogie. I saw it go across the room and I still remember where on my cheek it hit me. And I thought I was going to die for sure.
So, and this was, I think Jared was alluding to an H1N1 hit. It was a different bug, right? We were seeing these young, healthy 20-year-olds that were on death's door and had no disease. And we had some really young kids with the same thing. And so it was a different bug than what we had seen previously. And so during this scare, they started, the World Health Organization said, well, we could use oseltamivir. And countries spent $6.8 billion stockpiling the drug. So that stockpile kept going up, right? So the CDC has what's called a national stockpile, in case you didn't know. It's a strategic reserve where they basically have all these drugs, and they're sitting on pallets, and they're ready to be pushed in case of time of need. So if, say, a massive flu pandemic needs to get drugs out to a population, they can do it, right? So, but let's think about that. If you had a strategic reserve, how fast do you think you could get drugs out? And then we'll talk about when you're supposed to use oseltamivir. So just put that in the back of your head. Then 2009, another thing happened. There started to be some questions coming up. So at this point, Japan actually used 75% of the world's oseltamivir, partly probably because of bird flu, partly because they have money, and partly because they have a very dense population. So influenza is a big deal over there where they're so tightly packed population-wise. So during this time, Jefferson put out an article in 2009, and he had talked to a guy named Heiji, I'm going to probably butcher this because I don't know Japanese, but Hayashi, who is a pediatrician in Japan, who started noticing problems with the kids. And so the kids were starting to see hallucination and visual disturbances and psychiatric overtones and having significant vomiting. And he was also raising questions, and Jefferson did in this article as well, about, are we really seeing all the published data? And asking Roche to release the rest of the unpublished studies and stuff that had not come out. And so at this point, there started to be some connections where Roche has given a lot of money to the World Health Organization, and maybe Jefferson was talking about that oseltamivir recommendations were not based on just the literature, but more based on some contributions. And so Japan also had made a change, and their Ministry of Health had come out and actually prohibited Tamiflu use in 10 to 19-year-olds, and had given a warning saying we probably shouldn't use this because they were getting a number needed to harm. And you'll see this in most of the studies is around 20 for vomiting. So the number needed, if you're going to treat 20 patients with oseltamivir, you're probably going to give someone some vomiting. There's also some, so 2010 comes along. There's a guy named Heinoin who put in Clinical Infectious Disease, an article looking at, this was a small RCT of kids and saying, okay, what about kids? Oseltamivir, does it work? He had 1,000 kids he tried to look at, but only could get 400 into the studies, and was looking at kids for fever and upper respiratory symptoms within less than 24 hours. And they looked at these kids, about a quarter had influenza, most was influenza A, and in these kids, maybe most of the kids with group A would get better 2 to 4 days quicker. So they were showing some improvement. The kids, or the number of reduction in complications from influenza, none. So there was no complications, but maybe getting better faster, which is important for kids. They can get to school, not the 1 to 3-year-old age, but maybe for parents that they can get back to work. So that has some effect. 320 of the kids, though, had no effect. Didn't change. So of these 400 kids, maybe 1 in 5 is going to improve. But this is also treating kids within 24 hours of symptom onset. And do you want all these kids, say, coming to your ER or coming to see their doctor in that time? That's a hard number to catch kids at that age. But that was an RCT that was added to the evidence at that time. So 2011 comes along, and Roche says, after some pressure from Jefferson and some other people, okay, we'll release a little bit of some data. So they take out 29,000 pages of unpublished data and dump it to the, Jefferson and his group. Doshi in 2012 published in the British Medical Journal talking about the European Medical Agency had talked to Roche and trying to get more of these articles, but these were even some of the phase one and phase two trials, and we're not even getting the phase three trials. And they were having to sign non-disclosure agreements. Roche wanted them to sign non-disclosure, that you can look at this, but you can't talk about it, you can't tell anyone about it. You know, this is not good. And so Doshi was also talking about the amount of data that they were getting. It was taking two people, their full-time equivalent, their whole job, 14 months just to go through this data. Which, if you think about it, if the drug works, or if a drug works, right, you should be able to publish something, someone should be able to peer review it. It shouldn't take two people 14 months to go through all the data to decide if something works or doesn't work. So interesting. They also talked in the Doshi article about the placebos in these trials were not true placebos. So what do you mean not a true placebo, right? A placebo should be something that looks similar, tastes similar to the ingested pill, right? But is it should do nothing. It should be like nothing in that drug. But the placebos that they were using, they had two chemicals. So they had dehydrochloric acid and dibasic calcium phosphate dihydrate. Now, I have no idea what those are. They sound very chemically. But what they do is both of those chemicals cause vomiting. So why would you put in a chemical into your placebo that causes vomiting? Well, because now, if I know the major side effects of my drug is vomiting, and the harm that it could produce would be vomiting, if I gave a placebo with vomiting, that harm will be minimized in the literature. So, not having a good placebo, lots of data, this is not looking good in 2012. That same year, and you guys can Google this if you want, the British Medical Journal actually put out a guideline in, an open access campaign. It's the first time that I know of that any journal has put for any drug an open access campaign to show the correspondence, the literature, and talking about a campaign. And I mean, we have some sketchy drugs out there. We have some curious things that people have called back on. And this is the only one. Unless you guys, do you guys know of an open access campaign against any other drug?
Vioxx. I mean, there's plenty of other good ones.
What was the one we used to give for heart failure that came back?
Nesirotide.
Yeah. We had what was the
Zygris.
Zygris. Yeah. I mean, so we've had some drugs that have caused some pretty good harms that have been, you know, lawsuits and big time. But this is the first time that an open. So if you want to look up www.bmj.com/Tamiflu, you can do that. Or you can just type in BMJ and Tamiflu into your Google, and this will come up. And you can read through the stuff yourself, and you can educate yourself to make a better decision for you.
Or you can Twitter it using a pound sign. Pound sign Tamiflu, British Medical Journal. Up on the interweb.
On your MySpace the interweb.
The your space page?
On our MySpace page.
The your vacancy page.
It'll be on my AOL instant messenger.
I hear this dial-up tone. What should I do?
Oh, so gosh.
So, 2013, Mark Ebell, who's a family practice doc in Georgia, tries to do his own meta-analysis, again, looking at stuff. He's not funded by Roche. He actually, though, asked Roche for some of the unpublished studies. He's like, I'm writing this thing. I'd like to put it in. So he got about 8 different trials that were unpublished, 3 of which didn't have primary outcomes, which that should be a warning flag. So anyway, if you're ever looking at a trial, you should know what the primary outcome is for that trial before it's it's done, and it should be the same primary outcome after it's done. So that's number one, a red flag on some of those. But he looked at it, and this included 4,700 patients, and these were all patients with symptoms less than 36 hours. And so in the published study, he found that there was a one-day reduction in symptoms. In the unpublished studies, there was no difference. He also found that there was no difference in hospitalizations or complications requiring antibiotics. And he had also had to sign a non-disclosure agreement and could not publish any of the studies that he had talked about or the data from those studies that Roche had sent him. All right, so 2014's coming along, and Jefferson publishes again in the British Medical Journal and talks about a couple things. He talks about in 2013, Roche finally gave him some data, and he looked at it, and this is when they started to do a second Cochrane collaboration. Jefferson was in charge, and Doshi was also in on it for the second Cochrane collaboration. And they noticed for patients getting oseltamivir, they were going from about 7 days of symptoms to 6.3 with oseltamivir. So they were noticing, again, less than 24 hours, maybe 16 hours, maybe 24-hour reduction in symptoms in adults. During this time, also, they noted that the World Health Organization had put oseltamivir on the essential medicine list, which it's one of those things, if you want to look up, you can Google essential medicine list and see some of the drugs that are actually on that. And this was added in 2014.
Of note, it has since been downgraded by the World Health Organization to a complementary medicine, along with Wolfsbane and Grandma's Kisses.
Was chicken noodle soup elevated?
Chicken noodle soup is an essential part.
I think it is. It's essential.
As is 1980s movies, specifically the Back to the Future trilogy.
Yes. So Jefferson also talked about that they looked at kids and does it reduce symptoms in kids. They noticed about a one-day reduction in symptoms in kids, but they noted no reduction in kids with asthma. And so this is one of the groups that they talk about in the CDC and other places, right? You want to give it to kids with maybe pulmonary disease. And so one of the things Jefferson was talking about is maybe that it's not as much that the oseltamivir makes a difference, but in kids with asthma, and they came in with cough and shortness of breath, we do other things for them, like steroids and albuterol and doing other treatments, and maybe that's why we're not seeing the difference, whereas the kids with just flu symptoms, we were just giving them oseltamivir. So the number needed to harm, Jefferson was seeing, is again around 20, and that's for giving people vomiting. He also noted that it lowers influenza titers with oseltamivir, so that was something that they noted. So your titers are lower, but the prophylactic decrease in symptoms in influenza, but it doesn't stop disease spread. So the disease is still going to be spread whether you're taking it or not. You may stop some symptomatic with prophylaxis. So, okay, we're all in the room here. Maybe we should take oseltamivir. Maybe we won't catch it from Jared. That may help, but the titer spread or the disease spread is still going to happen. So kind of a weird thing, but it's more of if you're in family or close contact, they were noticing that it could help. Then 2015, Dobson came out with another meta-analysis. And you'll notice that there's a lot of meta-analysis for oseltamivir, but there's not a lot of new randomized controlled trials if you look at the literature. So basically, we're just keep cutting the pie different ways. So Dobson came out, and they said, oh, but there's a decrease in the need for antibiotic for lower respiratory infection. We kind of saw this in the Kaiser article, about a 10 to a 4%. Dobson said it went from 8 to 4%. So again, a reduction. And if you look at those, again, it's the same grouping. They're including bronchitis, acute otitis media, sinusitis, and pneumonia. And in the pneumonia group, there wasn't a difference. They also commented on the decreased need for hospitalization from 1.7% to 0.6, about a 1% decrease in hospitalization. They commented on a decreased symptom duration, so from 122 hours to 97 hours, so about 24 hours less, so a day less of symptoms. And they there was an increased nausea rate of 9% and a vomiting rate of 5%, but you're comparing that with a placebo vomiting rate of 5% and 3%, or nausea and vomiting of 5 and 3%, which probably goes along with some of these placebos that had some chemicals in it that would make you nauseous. Now, Dobson article is kind of interesting, too, because Dobson's study was funded by the Muggus. And this is, right, my tin hat's totally on now.
Those are the humans in the Harry Potter world, right?
The Muggus is the multi-parity group for advice on science. And most of you are probably familiar with that. I was not, so I looked it up. And it's a group.
That's really kind of you to think that any of us had any idea what that was.
So the Muggus group actually gets an unrestricted grant from Roche, and they then fund the CDC. So that was kind of an interesting thing. And the CDC actually gets about 20% of all of their funding comes from drug industry. So that's got to raise some questions, right? When you hear that the CDC is getting 20% of their funding from industry, you have a meta-analysis that's saying this drug is good, we should use it. The numbers are maybe a little bit better, but they're not outstanding, right? This isn't like I took a symptoms from 7 days down to a 2 days. This isn't that, you know, we stopped everyone from getting into the hospital. But now you've got a lot of conflicts of interest that start to happen, right? So Roche says, oh, no, no, we gave them all of our data, right? It's not because they're related to us or anything. It's not that we funded anything. We gave Dobson all the data that Jefferson had asked for in the Cochrane collaboration. Why? Because we're good people. Because Roche says they gave it all. But then you look at some of the study authors. And all of the authors, three of the four co-authors on the Dobson article, received either consulting fees from Roche or direct funding, or they spoke on behalf of Roche worldwide. So now we have the authors of an article funded by a group sponsored by a drug company touting mild benefits of a drug. So what did this happen? Well, 2015, Jeannie Lenzer, who is one of the editors of the BMJ, published another article, an opinion piece on this, and talking about a lot of these conflicts, and are we really seeing the true science of oseltamivir? And that's what I think is evidence-based people. We really want to try to get, just tell us the data. You know, don't hide it. Just if it works, it works. Great. If it doesn't work, that's fine, too. We just want to know that, but let us make an educated decision based on real data. Don't hide and give us something so we're not having to backtrack like these other drugs that we talked about. And so one of the things that Jeannie Lenzer talks about is the FDA has commented on oseltamivir and said that it has not proven to have a positive impact on the potential consequences such as hospitalization, mortality, or economic impact of seasonal avian or pandemic influenza. So now with a statement like that from the FDA, within our own country, we have a CDC and FDA having dichotomous opinions on a drug. And so what is that? I mean, that's, I don't know, raises questions for me. And again, I want you to be skeptical.
I think that's government.
Yeah. And it's true. It's one of these, right? And government, you can have, because everyone's in their own different pots and they're fighting for their own money, so you can have conflicts. But at the same time, when we talk about health issues, we would hope there's some symmetry with organizations, and especially if they're, you know, if there's a true benefit, you would think we should all line up and be on the same page. So, the CDC director, Thomas Friedman, at the time, had said that the evidence indicates that oseltamivir will shorten how long you're sick, might keep you out of the hospital, and could even save your life. Now, if you look at any randomized control trial of oseltamivir, there has never been a mortality benefit proven in any of these studies, nor do any of these meta-analyses look at mortality because there is no difference. What they're really looking at is hospitalization, symptom duration, maybe secondary infections. That's the running theme if you heard through any of these articles. That's really what they're looking at, and which is a real difference, right? If patients don't have to stay in the hospital, if they get better faster, they get back to work, that's an economical impact. So to the fact that he's coming out and adding can even save your life is a little bit scary.
I will add, this is one of the other things Chris wanted to bring up, was part of, you know, thinking thinking about it from a population standpoint, if Tamivir can get Americans back to work 24 hours sooner, increase productivity, and maybe decreased infectivity, that maybe there is a benefit to that. And that's kind of down the line, a far cry from a mortality benefit.
Right. And so that's, I mean, I think all these are real differences. What we want to be able to do is to truly state to our patient what that real difference is. Now, one of the, so 2006, which is probably the last major change with all this, is a generic came out for oseltamivir. So now you can get oseltamivir for like $50-$75 for a generic. So, long rant and kind of background information on oseltamivir, but I think one of the things that, looking in the literature on this, there really isn't good comparisons of, say, oseltamivir to good supportive care, right? If someone comes in with cough or fevers or chills or sore throat or congestion, there's lots of drugs we know that maybe can reduce some of those things, but there isn't, say, a study that looks at oseltamivir with good supportive care. And I think whether you, you know, one of my takeaway points and frustrates me so much is whether you use oseltamivir or not, if you want to prescribe it to someone, please do not prescribe it as the only thing that you give a patient, because that's not going to help them. Please give them some other drugs for their muscle aches and their headache and their sore throat and their congestion, and, you know, whether those are great drugs and they work all the time. But please, if they have vomiting, give them something for vomiting, and don't just say oseltamivir will do it. So I will pause here and let Aaron and Allie put me my straitjacket back on.
Allie, wake up.
Thanks. No. I mean, I was going to say, I've heard Brian talk about this before in lectures to the residents and other controversies in medicine, and Brian obviously is very well read in all of these things, but I think the fascinating thing really is the BMJ's open communication and email threads that have really been going on, and I think the lack of transparency is market and something that should really raise a red flag in everything. And, you know, that's true for communication in life in general. If you see a lack of transparency, you have to question where that motivation is coming from. And there was a paper that we read about the likelihood to report favorable results based on the funding, you know, or the conflicts of interest related to the authors. And that was not questionable, right? I mean, 7 out of 8 studies that were funded by the industry were reported favorable results from oseltamivir, whereas, you know, a minority of those that were not funded reported a positive result. So, I mean, I think while Brian may or may not be in a straitjacket, I think the data really, you know, is hard to argue that there's something fishy.
And Brian may be in a straitjacket for other reasons, but I think you can't deny the effect of the direct-to-patient marketing that they do. I mean, I love the commercial of the giant guy in the tiny house with the tiny Kleenex that's like, when you have a flu, you've got big flu. You don't have little flu. You need something potent. And so it's hard because the patient expects that it's antibiotics. They expect that they're going to feel better. And so I'm very cautious to tell patients when they ask about Tamiflu, look, if you had pyelonephritis, you had cystitis, you had pneumonia, you had an ear infection, you'll feel better after a couple of days of antibiotics. If you have influenza, you're still going to have fevers. You're still going to have body aches. You're still going to have congestion and cough. You're still going to have vomiting, to which they usually ask, then why would I take it? And I say, I don't know, but this is it. The other thing I'm very cautious to say is that don't break the bank on this. If you're not insured and it's $300, you are not going to get your benefit from it. I'm almost certain. Unless you have a condition that's a little more concerning. You know, the CDC does have guidelines of who they're concerned about. They recommend it in all children aged less than 2, all adults greater than 65, people with chronic pulmonary disease, renal, hepatic, hematologic, metabolic. So, you know, including diabetes. So all diabetics should get oseltamivir. People with HIV, women who are pregnant, people on long-term aspirin therapy who are kids for concern of Reye syndrome, that's one of the issues, American Indians and Alaskan Natives, all people who are morbidly obese, and residents of nursing homes and other chronic care facilities. I think you've described all but two people that have come into the emergency department.
I think it also is women who are not pregnant, those who are working, those who are not working, those who are living, and those who are not living. All should be included. If not, please see your doctor.
Unless they can't afford it.
Although hypertension alone does not count as cardiovascular disease. So, you know, if their only problem is hypertension, then they don't really need it.
I think part of this is, right, we should talk, why do these things exist? So why does oseltamivir exist? It really exists for a couple things, right? It's similar to other drugs. We have what I would call an influenza vacuum, right? There is a disease that hurts people, that affects a lot of people, and kills people every year. And it happens worldwide, and we don't have a good answer for it. And so now you have this vacuum of, we don't know what to do. We're doing a flu shot. We're trying to do some disease prevention. But hey, there's this one drug, and it's beautiful, and it could do something. And so what do as doctors? Oh, I've got to give it. I think we've seen this in stroke care, right? Strokes is devastating, and this is not another soapbox, but just another analogy. Strokes are devastating, but we don't really have a great answer to stop a stroke or to reverse a stroke. But all of a sudden, there's TPA. And so obviously we should do it, because doing nothing is worse than doing something. And so you have this, and unfortunately, you know, this drug has made a lot of money for Roche. It has made them $18 billion. So, you know, take that for what it is, but this is a little moneymaker for them. And unfortunately, it's probably hurting some people. You know, does it have benefit? It may. Do we know specifically who it we should give it to? Probably not. And as Aaron and Allie are saying, it doesn't have a real significant benefit that you're going to be as a doctor. I can't in good faith go and say you have to take this drug. And if it's going to break the bank at $50 or $75 or $300 versus maybe some chicken noodle soup, some Tylenol, Motrin, here's a work note for 10 weeks, I don't care. You know, go home, sleep, here's some Benadryl, go to bed. You know, do whatever you want to do, drink some honey, have some Halls, put on your favorite binge watching Netflix, and we'll see you in the summertime.
I mean, I think we live in a society where, you know, people, half of our patients take a couple doses of penicillin that their aunt had left over for whatever their complaint might be, you know, from a toothache to diarrhea to who knows. So I think, you know, as Aaron and Brian have said, a lot of our job is managing patient expectations. And, you know, the best you can do is present them with objective data and help them make a decision that makes sense for them. And, you know, most of our patients expect to leave with a prescription for something. And I think your job is to really walk them through the options and figure out what's right. And, you know, patient satisfaction is what it is, but your job is to be the doctor and to make an help them make an informed decision. You know, we haven't talked about the other class of drugs for flu. Mostly I wanted to talk about it just so I could call them adamantine, because then I can make a Wolverine inference, but you're not supposed to use them anymore because there's too much resistance. But
I know some of you may be saying, okay, well, the guidelines say I should do something. And, you know, I think us as physicians, you know, I've recently been saying guidelines in Latin mean for brains, but what I really mean is that guidelines are guidelines. I think truly guidelines are there to give you a basis if you really don't understand how to approach a disease process. So say you're the psychiatrist that's on the floor and someone has a code, and you know, ACLS for you is good, but for us as practicing emergency physicians, I used to take ACLS and PALS and ATLS, but I don't think, you know, Aaron Aaron or Allie, I don't know if you guys do it, but I don't do it on a regular basis anymore. Why? Because I think I have a better, deeper understanding from my specialty field and know what, how best to apply those guidelines and what they really are used for. So guidelines, in a sense, also should be, you know, who are they made by? They're made by old guys who've been in the field and been, you know, in this area of research for a long time, and they're viewed as experts. Just because you're an expert in a field doesn't mean you should be the one making the guidelines. Guidelines truly should be made by people who are independent of the drugs, of the disease processes, of the research in that area, met with methodologists working together to critically appraise the literature and what's out there. Then they should contact those experts with their questions and opinions and wanting to see what they have to say, but then they can make a rational, unbiased approach. And unfortunately, most of our guidelines have influences by expert opinion, drug companies, and other things that don't give us the true meaning of what we're trying to get to, which is the truth and what the real evidence says without some other bias.
To be fair, I think you do have to be skeptical, but to be completely independent and help to form guidelines, you have to have knowledge of what's going on. And in order to actually be knowledgeable enough to set guidelines, it's very difficult to be independent and unbiased. I mean, if you know all this stuff, you have to have learned it from somewhere. And so I think the guidelines do the best they can. And I think that, as Brian said, you have to be skeptical of certain guidelines. Like the CDC has done a great job of pushing vaccines on a society that for quite a while did not want them until finally they were able to prove it. This may be a point where they've fallen. I'm not quite sure. But I think that guidelines in general, you have to apply it to your patient themselves. I kind of like, there's a, I don't know, it was a poem or something. It was the history of medicine. It was medicine started, eat this root. And then a few years later, you know, a couple centuries later, that root's heathen, say this prayer. A couple more. No, that prayer's superstition. Drink this potion. And then, no, that potion's snake oil. Here, take this medicine. And then it's, no, that medicine's bad for you. Here, eat this root. I mean, we've come full circle again. And so it gets down to the point of where we as a society want you to do something. So the best treatment for your patient is for you to actually sit down with them, address their concerns, and be fully honest. I'm fully honest with my patients about every single thing I've ever tried to do when I get sick, everything I've ever done for my kids when they get sick. And when they ask, like, well, what do I do about this? There is nothing else I can offer you. I would try anything you've ever heard of that doesn't sound dangerous. You know, don't do cough syrup if your kid is young. Don't drink boiling water to try to kill the infections. A literal thing I was asked. These are things that you try to help direct them, but really it's all supportive care. And we as physicians especially don't like that. I want the cure. We don't have a cure for this. There's no cure for the common cold.
So let me ask you guys this. Patients that come in that are going to be admitted to the hospital. We've been talking about kind of the walking flu and people that you're going to send home with good counseling and, you know, informed decision making regarding prescriptions. But what about the patients that you're admitting? Are you testing and treating? What are you doing with those people?
I'll be honest, I am. If I've got a little baby who comes in for like neonatal sepsis, they got a fever and they're 28 days old, or they're 2 months old or so, and I'm worried about how they look, I'm treating them. And if I'm sending them home, I'm definitely treating them. For that reason, because they are high risk. This is not just the average kid that walks in who's 5 years old and looks crummy, but vital signs are okay. They're keeping well hydrated. I don't think I'll have any effect on that kid with oseltamivir. For the younger ones, there's a part of me that just says, I am worried, and so I want to do something. The side effects, it's all risk versus benefit. So for the younger kids, I do.
I test people only if I'm admitting them so that they can be put on respiratory precautions to decrease spread of disease. So that's the group that I test. If I see a patient and my plan is for home, I won't test them, partly because I'm not going to treat them. I don't treat anyone with oseltamivir. I don't treat anyone going home, nor do I treat the inpatient ones. I let the inpatient team make that decision if they want to do it, because they're going to be continuing on the therapy or not. And there's, no, you know, does it decrease hospitalizations? No, but I'm already hospitalizing this patient, so does it matter? Probably not, because what is the complication? I'm going to help. I don't have one that I know of, so I don't treat it. And there isn't, you know, this isn't an antibiotic in sepsis that I've seen, where time to antibiotics for a septic patient, I think we're starting to see, probably makes a difference. I don't have a time to oseltamivir that makes a difference. So to me, I don't do it. Just like I don't give my acute coronary syndromes Lipitor, though probably in the first 24 hours, maybe anti-cholesterol or beta blockers helps. Mm-hmm. So to me, I leave that up to them, because they're going to be managing the patient and deciding what's best for them.
And I think, you know, in looking at these patients, the sick flu, deciding who's going to go home, who's going to stay, there are the obvious patients that are shocky, that are hypoxic, that are going to the ICU. You've intubated them. Those ones are not coming in with flu-like symptoms. I wonder if you should be admitted. Then there's the patients that you have normal vital signs, tolerating PO, they're doing well. They can go home, but they're going to feel crummy, and I make sure they know about that. The in-betweeners are tough for me. When I've got a CF patient with influenza, I don't like that underlying chronic disease that is potentially going to get thrown off. So I may admit them after a discussion with the patient about what I'm worried about. And I'm pretty, the more I've done medicine, the easier it is for me to explain to a patient when I don't know the right thing to do. I need your help, because here's what I'm considering. Tell me what you're thinking. You know, would you feel okay going home and coming back, or would you rather stay in the hospital? And we keep people in the hospital for all kinds of reasons that are, you know, frankly, a little bit on the fringe. And so if it goes with their worry and I'm worried and I can convince somebody else to be worried, at least for 24 hours, then maybe it'll be worth it. And that's, for me, how I figure out which flu patients are going to go home or which ones are going to stay. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I use abnormal vital signs. So the more hypoxic you are, you know, the more likely I am to keep you. If you can't keep fluids down, because some of these influenza patients are a lot of vomiting, diarrhea, and they are way behind, or they have a new acute kidney injury, you know, I got to admit those patients. But, you know, increased work of breathing or just not looking right, I think. Because a lot of these people, if they have good vital signs, clear lungs, and can keep liquids down, they're probably going to go home. That's my general take. Even if they, you know, have their eyes closed, like, I don't feel good, and their heart rate's 70 and their SATs 96, I don't know. It'd be very hard for me to find a reason to admit them. And part of the other thing is, right, we're in a time here in Tucson where all the hospitals are full. And I know, you know, this is maybe sacrilege, but I change my practice based on what I have. You know, maybe I'm going to send them home and have them come back in 12 hours and see me and admit them, and hopefully we have beds the next day, as opposed to them sitting in my ER and coughing in a non, you know, shared room with other patients. You know, what's the best idea, big health wise? And I don't know.
I feel like that fits within the milestone of system-based practices.
Right.
Ooh.
Right?
Wow.
I know.
That's good, because I've never found anything to fit in that milestone. So now I have something to judge the residents on.
I feel like the other patient population that I tend to think more about are those that are immunosuppressed. We see a lot of transplant patients here, and I think that's the other one where I definitely take a little more time to ponder it, and I'm probably more likely to treat than not, you know, scientific or otherwise. But I think, again, that's the feeling like I should do something, and that if you weighing the risks and benefits and, you know, how I would feel if something were to happen to them and I had the opportunity to do something, I think that weighs in.
Well, I think,
bit.
Yeah, transplant patients, for me at least, I end up contacting the transplant
sure.
team because
right.
they're on such drugs that I am not good with and side effects and everything. So I would want them involved because they seem to be very involved in their care too. So I actually defer to what they would prefer.
Yeah, I agree.
I think, if I can summarize, I think that with influenza, it allows us to get back to the art of medicine. Because the science of it is not something that affects us as much in the emergency department. We treat influenza according to the severity of the patient. We've got some medicine that may or may not be helpful, but it's not clear, hard science. There's guidelines, there's recommendations. If you come in and you've broken your ankle, I need to set your ankle and I need to splint it, or else we're going to have a bad outcome. Nobody will doubt that. But how you work up flu, how you treat flu is a little bit of the art of medicine. You need to understand your patient population. You need to have a discussion with your patients. And hopefully from that, you can come to a medical practice that, even though it may differ from somebody else, is rooted in the little bit of science we have with flu, as far as clinical flu treatment goes, and does what's best for your patient.
And I think it's... I give a lot of prescriptions. You know, Allie was saying our patients come in, they want a prescription, right? And so I will treat these patients with, they will get 6 prescriptions at a time from me sometimes. I will give them Tylenol, Motrin, Sudafed, Benadryl, Afrin, Zofran if they're having, Imodium if they need it, you know, a magic mouthwash so they can gargle and help with their sore throat, and a work note because I don't want them to spread it. I want them to go home, rest, and recover. I tell them to drink lots of fluids, get lots of sleep. But I try to treat whatever symptom they have as best I can, because that's what, I mean, all we're here for is alleviating suffering. This, you know, it's hard to, you can't cure influenza. Time cures influenza. We're just supporting.
Your immune system cures
it. Right, your immune system cures it. But even, you know, we talk, if Jared's gone now, but, you know, ECMO and all this ICU stuff is still really good supportive care. And, you know, when we admit patients to hospital, we're admitting them for support. Supporting the needs that they have. And, you know, if they have a little wheeze or crackles, they give them albuterol. Maybe I give them a dose of steroids if they're wheezing too. So you're giving all these medicines for symptomatic care and giving them their best shot. I think that's right. This is the art of medicine. But you have to talk to your patients with what you do. So I'll be in the one corner by myself, not testing, not treating, and people will look at me strange. But that's okay. It's not the first time.
And with that, I'm going to disinfect my brand new office from influenza. Thanks, Jared.
Bleach it all.
Hello, everybody. My name's Dr. Catherine Hiller, Professor of Emergency Medicine, University of Arizona, Department of Emergency Medicine. I'm kind of our department's resident floozy. I've been interested in influenza for almost 20 years now. In fact, when I was a resident on my tox rotation, we were supposed to pick a drug to discuss the side effects for, and I picked the influenza vaccine. Rick Dart, the director of the Poison Center, was not amused, but I did learn a lot. And ever since, I've been very interested in influenza, so thank you very much for allowing me the chance to peer review this amazing podcast on influenza. I'll start by saying I thought the discussion about vaccines was awesome. Yes, they are not 100% effective. Yes, they are not live viruses, not anymore anyway, which means there's no way that you can get the flu from the traditional intramuscular flu shot. One thing that I didn't hear, and that this is a relatively new thing with flu vaccines, is they're now quadrivalent. The banner flu vaccine, unfortunately, this year, the one that we all got as employees, was not quadrivalent, it was trivalent. But now most vaccines actually have 2 strains of flu B in them as well. And that ties into one of the things I wanted to mention about the podcast was we're talking a lot about how effective flu vaccine is. And that word has a very specific meaning when it comes to disease. When we talk about effectiveness, it's different than efficacy. And one of the things that comes up when talking about flu vaccines is how good of a match is it with the circulating strains this year. And it turns out that this year's match with the circulating strains is very good. but that's a marker of efficacy, not necessarily effectiveness. So you may not actually get protection from the shot this year with the same circulating strains, even though there is a good match. As far as I know, no one really understands why. Everything matches up, but for some reason we're just not getting a whole lot of effectiveness against prevention for the flu. Right now, currently, we're at about 30 to 40% effectiveness, but that number's higher in kids. It's about 60% in kids. And there is actually some data that shows that even if you only vaccinated the kids, who are the walking little snotty vectors that really transmit flu, you would get some herd immunity and improved outcomes even in adults. So that's a good thing. 60% effectiveness in kids is awesome. The other thing I wanted to mention was there was some discussion about sort of lowercase flu and uppercase influenza. And I like the description that Jared gave of sudden onset, high fever, and feel like you're hit by a truck. So it turns out that there is actually a definition for influenza-like illness, and it's a fever of 100.8 or 38 degrees centigrade, plus one of the following: cough, headache, or sore throat. So when the CDC tracks cases of influenza, they certainly track lab verified influenza, but they also track influenza-like illness, and that's the definition that's used. I took some notes while I was listening to this, and the next thing that came up in my notes was a little bit about epidemiology and how sometimes we screen for things for epidemiologic reasons so that we can determine what the prevalence in the community currently is. And influenza, in my mind, and I agree with Brian Drummond on this one, is very much a clinical diagnosis. And in fact, your clinical gestalt is going to be about as good as the ELISA assay, that rapid flu swab that Jared does not like at all, and I agree, I don't like it either. The manufacturer's sensitivity and specificity for the ELISA assay is somewhere between 70 and 90% for each of them, but in practice that's actually much smaller. And the truth is it doesn't even really matter, because when we order a test in the emergency department, we're not actively thinking about false positives, false negatives. What we're thinking about is when I get this test result back and it's a positive or it's a negative, what's the likelihood that that's true? And we call that a positive predictive value or a negative predictive value. And that becomes really important in flu, because while the equation for sensitivity and specificity are actually quite simple, you remember false positives, false negatives over false positive plus false negatives, the equation for positive predictive value also includes a variable on prevalence. So when the prevalence of the disease that you're testing is low, it turns out that the positive predictive value is actually quite bad. And if you have a low sensitivity and specificity on top of that, the positive predictive value is probably less than your clinical gestalt. Aaron made a point of talking about how if you need to use the test to get an idea of what flu looks like as a training resident, that that's fine. My point would be that we're ordering ELISA a lot less commonly now, and we shouldn't be relying on it because of the problem with positive and negative predictive value that I just brought up. So we're basically ordering a $400 PCR test, and that's kind of expensive training wheels to figure out, quote, what a disease looks like. So I get the sentiment, but I'm not sure I'm totally on board with that model of learning. It's probably better just to see who actually has influenza and really get a good look at them in the department. So that's how I feel about testing. Brian's discussion about Tamiflu was interesting and long, and he's definitely spent way more time on this than I ever had. In general, I think I agree with him in the sense that I don't think Tamiflu does much of anything. Having said that, I think when we practice medicine, and I think Allie brought this up, it's not necessarily evidence-based medicine that we all rely on. Sometimes we rely on the court of public opinion as well. There was a recent media article that talked about a woman who died of flu because, quote, she didn't fill her Tamiflu prescription. And we all know that that's not why she died from flu. But that's the public perception. And I think this concept of working with the art of medicine so that you can meet patients' expectations when you can and hopefully do no harm is important. And that's why I think the data about mental status changes, and I think there's an entire case series now about suicide in patients who are on oseltamivir. Those kind of negative side effects are really important in this case, because if the risk-benefit ratio shows very little benefit, but it's some serious risk, then we absolutely should not be giving the medication. There was a discussion about the CDC guidelines as well, and I wanted to bring up that, first of all, those are guidelines. They're suggestions. They're not even recommendations at this point. And it's an interesting list, and some of the elements of the list might be counterintuitive, but I just wanted to point out that that list is basically identical to the list that existed before the 2009 epidemic, with a couple of rare exceptions, and is basically the list of patients who would suffer complications from influenza. So think about your asthmatic who gets influenza. They're definitely more at risk for pulmonary disease, for being intubated in the ICU on, you know, multiple different nebs and pressors, etc. Think about the patient who has some kind of neurologic disorder who aspirates, a post-stroke patient or a neuromuscular disorder patient, or a seizure patient even, who has a seizure while they've got flu. So they're much higher risk for complications from influenza. And that's where that list that the CDC comes up with came from. It's basically identical to the list that happened before Tamiflu was even a thing. These are the patients who are at risk for complications from influenza. Now, the 2009 pandemic really hit, and it did provide some insight into the population of young people who, for whatever reason, have this hyperimmune response to the H1N1. And Jared's right, this is definitely an H1N1 type phenomenon. The more classic H3N2 is the one that kills older people, and that's what the 1918 pandemic was. And then B tends to be, quote, milder disease, although if you talk to any of us who've been doing this for a while, we've definitely seen people who had very serious complications from even type B flu. So the interesting kind of subgroup analyses that came out of the pandemic showed that for whatever reason, pregnant women, morbidly obese women, and people of Alaskan, Native American, Inuit heritage are at risk. And so for whatever reason, they have more complications, they're more likely to have that bad immunogenic response, and that's how they made it to that list. I think the last thing I wanted to bring up was the discussion about the flu pandemic. So it turns out that just the natural course of influenza over the course of history is that we have an epidemic about every 3 years. And this year was definitely one of those years. You can look at the graph of the incidence of influenza, of influenza-like illness, of pneumonia, and influenza mortality. And they all have spikes every 3 years or so. Pandemics, which is truly a new strain of influenza that no one is immune to, happen roughly every 20 years or so. We had one in 2009, so we should be good for a little while longer. And in fact, there hadn't been a pandemic for a really long time before 2009, about 30 or 40 years. So this concept of a bad flu year is not a new concept. It happens about every 3 years, and we should be prepared for that. Hopefully this means that the next couple years will be relatively mild. The 1918 flu pandemic 100 years ago this year killed more people than World War I. 40 million people died. 10 times more Americans died of the flu than died in World War I. Mortality rate was about 2.5%. I can't think of any other disease that hits that many people with such a high mortality rate. And Brian's right, the average life expectancy dropped by 12 years. It was 55 years at the onset of the flu epidemic, and then it was close to 40 by the end. So it was a really big deal, and we're now seeing much better mortality rates from influenza, largely in part to excellent advances in critical care medicine. There was a recent review of recent influenza and pneumonia mortality, and the numbers now are closer to somewhere between 12 and 50,000 people die every year of flu. And that's much different than 80 to 100,000 people. So we've done a good job on the back end once people actually get influenza of treating it. We need to work more, I think, on the front end of getting people vaccinated and improving the effectiveness of the vaccine. Thanks again for letting me do this. It was a lot of fun. If anyone wants to talk about flu, please let me know.